Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. If ever there was an unassailable mantra in economics, it's growth. Growth is the sign of a healthy economy, the saying goes, of a prosperity and progress. GDP, the godly data point. And the presumption isn't just that growth is good. It's that growth is good forever and unconstrained. But some economists now are breaking away from the pack and saying valuing growth above all is exactly the approach that will drive nations and the planet off a cliff. That developed capitalist economies need a new measure of progress and especially of prosperity. That we shouldn't be afraid of a GDP growth rate of zero. That maybe we should even aim for it. So this hour on Point, GDP growth and the new economics of progress. And we've got a couple terrific economists joining us now to help us wrestle with this question about slow or no growth economies. Joining us from Houston, Texas is Dietrich Wohlrath. Dietrich is chair of the University of Houston's Department of Economics and author of a new book, Fully Grown, Why a Stagnant Economy is a Sign of Success. Professor Wohlrath, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Oxford, England, is Kate Raworth. She's an ecological economist at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. Professor Raworth, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna.
It's a delight to have you both. And by the way, folks, we have excerpts of both of their books at onpointradio.org, so check it out. And while you're there, look for the link to John Cassidy's terrific article in the New Yorker magazine about a new measure for prosperity. That is the inspiration for this hour of conversation today. So again, all that is at onpointradio.org. But Professor Wohlrath, let's just start with sort of a little bit of background here before we dive into the thinking about slow or zero growth economies. Why has growth been seen as the ultimate indicator of a nation's economic health for so long? What is it about growth that tells us something important about a nation?
Well, I think one way to look at it is that for a long time, the things that were associated with higher well-being, kind of in the broad sense that we might all agree on, the more material goods, when starting out from when we're very poor, adding food, adding shelter, adding, putting electricity and plumbing into houses, all these things that were part of expanding well-being also happened to be really tightly tied into clear, countable economic activity. And so GDP and GDP growth was kind of a good metric that was closely associated with kind of improved well-being on a lot of material measures. And then what's been happening and what we'll get into over the course of this hour, I'm sure, is that that's kind of started to that relationship has started to fray.
So, Kate, same question to you. I mean, GDP is it's a easy to understand, at least superficially, metric, but it's also kind of a crude one, is it not?
Indeed. I mean, if we think of it, what is GDP? It's gross domestic product. It's the monetary value of the products and services that are sold in an economy in a year. That's what it tells us. The value of stuff that was sold. It doesn't tell you what was sold. And I absolutely agree with Dietrich that I'd say in the 20th century, especially, I mean, GDP was invented in the 1930s. And in the 40s, 50s, 60s, it was a really good measure, as he describes, of improving welfare because we had labor-intensive industries. So if the number of things that being made and sold was going up, more people were being employed. That means more people were getting a wage. That means more people could buy a house, send their kids to school, have good health care, buy the things they needed. The GDP and rising welfare were coupled, and they are beginning to come apart.
So we'll talk about that decoupling in a minute here. But let's also just underscore that there are still many places in this world, important rising economies, where GDP still is providing that measure, is it not? I mean, I'm thinking of, not right now, but in years past, Dietrich, like China's growth rate, that astronomical 6-7% they were posting, was also telling us about a change in prosperity for the Chinese people themselves.
Right. I mean, I think so. GDP is exactly what Professor Rayworth was saying is it is exactly that measure of goods and services produced in a year. There's a very technical definition of it that is well associated with well-being at certain levels of development, such as you might see in India or China. The example I always use in class and such is think of GDP as a fitness tracker or a step counter for the economy. It's a number, and it's a nice tangible number. It's an easy to count number, and it has meaning for your health in certain situations. If you say are a little overweight or you got a heart issue, then seeing your steps go up and up and up every day is probably a good sign that you're moving in the right direction. That maybe breaks down though when you become healthy and maybe you start swimming and now you're not stepping as much, but you're still in a healthy state. So for developing countries, for sure, GDP can still be a good barometer of improvements, but we need to separate perhaps each separate situation perhaps needs to be thought of in its own context.
If I can just add some fantastic studies have shown across low-income countries that from very low levels of income per person up to around $12,000 per person, there are phenomenal benefits of rising income in life expectancy, in kids going to school, in health, in child survival. So to answer that question, for the poorest countries in the world, absolutely, they need to see incomes rising because then they can start to publicly invest in the things and individual households can buy the things that make us all able to thrive and survive. Mm-hmm. It then begins to taper off, and as the richer countries get, the less and less convincing it is that what's going to make your life better or what's going to make our nation's life better is more growth.
Well, we are talking about a new way of thinking about that GDP number and whether or not developed capitalistic economies should be aiming for slow or zero growth even. And folks, what would slow or no growth an economy like that look like? Or if we turn away from growth as a way to judge the economy, are we turning our backs on progress, on prosperity? Now, Dietrich and Kate, before we get to like what this decoupling is that you're both talking about, I still want to spend a minute about the hold that growth has on our on our economics and our politics here. So first of all, let's just listen for a moment to how presidents over the past 40 years have talked about economic growth.
Our economy is not getting older and weaker. It's getting younger and stronger.
We have built a new economy. And our economic revolution has been matched by a revival of the American spirit.
A future of hope and opportunity begins with a growing economy. And that is what we have.
For the past 7 years, our goal has been a growing economy that also works better for everybody. We've made progress, but we need to make more.
The U.S. economy is growing almost twice as fast today as when I took office, and we are considered far and away the hottest economy anywhere in the world, not even close.
That's Presidents Reagan, Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, and Trump from various State of the Union addresses over the past 40 years. Kate Rayworth, we wanted to sort of play that to show that if a president says anything other than the economy in the United States is growing, it's suicidal. It's politically suicidal, virtually. That's how important this idea of growth at all costs is.
Yes, and that was just a wonderful montage of voices. All of those men were actually harking back to another man, John F. Kennedy, because in 1960, he was the first American president to stand explicitly on a platform of promising a 5% growth rate. And the 60s were really the hold of GDP thinking. It was the golden time that GDP had so far over the last two decades just delivered and delivered. And there's a wonderful story that as soon as he got elected, he turned to his chief economic advisor and said, do you think we can deliver on that growth rate? You know, can we keep this promise? But it's stuck, this mantra of growth. And so I want to turn from those wonderful voices of so many men to the voice of a very wise woman who in the 1970s, Donella Meadows, one of the mothers of systems thinking, she said, growth is one of the stupidest purposes ever invented by any culture. We've got to have an enough. And when anyone calls for more growth, we must ask, growth of what? Yeah. And why? And for whom? And who pays the cost? And how long can it last? And what's the cost of the planet? And how much is enough? And we have not asked that question enough until now.
You know, it's interesting. We haven't asked that question enough, but it has popped up before because I'm thinking you mentioned JFK in 1960. It was only a couple of years later, in 1968, that Robert Kennedy said GDP measures everything that's worth everything except that which is worthwhile in life.
Yes.
We've been asking this question for a long time. Why is it taking up so much or becoming more urgent now, Kate?
Well, can I jump back a second? So does it have this grip? Because you asked, why does it have this grip? And I just want to step back from economics, actually, just to the deep metaphors of life. Growth is a wonderful thing. It means things are alive, right? We love to see our children grow. We love to see our gardens grow. It's spring in parts of the world. We are looking for those shoots on the trees. So growth is a wonderful, healthy phase of life. No wonder we humans use it so often as a metaphor for things going well. But in nature, nothing grows forever. Mm-hmm. Things grow and then they grow up. Indeed, if my children, who are now age 11 and growing very fast and it's very expensive in terms of shoes, if they were to grow forever, they literally could not sit at my table. They would no longer belong in my household. And we actually know another end of this metaphor. If I told you my friend had gone to the doctor and the doctor told her she had a growth, that feels completely different. And the first thing we want to do to that growth, which we use as a symbol for a tumor, is to stop it. Because we know that within our own bodies, which are dynamic, healthy, complex living systems, when something within them tries to grow forever, it's a threat to the whole. So we need to take that from our body to the planetary whole and reconsider our relationship to growth.
Well, we are talking about a new wave of economists looking at the positive benefits of a zero or slow growth economy. Kate Raworth and Dietrich Wohlrath join us. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the possibility of a slow or zero growth economy. What would that look like? What would it mean if GDP didn't rise at all, or the rate of GDP growth didn't go up at all? Would it mean that we're actually finally, as a nation, as a planet, beginning to live within our means? Or would it mean we're turning our back on prosperity or the conventional means of achieving prosperity? Those are the questions we're wrestling with this hour. And Dietrich Wohlrath joins us to help us with that. Dietrich is chair of the University of Houston's Department of Economics and author of Why a Stagnant Economy is a Sign of Success. And Kate Raworth also joins us from Oxford, England. Kate is an ecological economist at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. And Dietrich, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but Kate, I would like to just press you on something a little bit, if I could. In preparing for this conversation yesterday, you spoke with our producer, Steph Katsonis, and you actually even went further in your analysis about our growth addiction in developed Western economies, right? Like, we have quarterly reports for corporations that are heavily reliant on posting growth. We heard all those politicians beforehand. We're politically addicted to growth. I mean, is this kind of a sickness? Is it an illness in Western economies?
Well, we face an extremely strange situation that I'm sitting here in the UK, you're in the US. The US has the 10th highest income per person in the world at the moment. I live in equally a high-income country. We are living in countries that are richer than any countries have ever been before. And yet still we believe that the solution to all of our ills, no matter how rich our countries already are, the solutions lie in yet more growth. Now, there's something addictive about that, pathological, that we believe that a country must keep growing forever, no matter how rich it already is. And I believe it's because we are financially, politically, and socially structurally addicted to endless growth. You just mentioned the financial system. At the heart of our financial system is the drive to maximize the return on investment. And that means that all publicly traded companies, I speak to chief financial officers, and they say, we want to be more sustainable, we want to be more ethical, but every quarter we have to show that we have growing sales, growing profits, and growing market share. Otherwise, the markets punish us. They are structurally caught in the pursuit of endless growth. Politicians know, as you heard in those speeches, they have to deliver on this outdated idea that GDP going up is the predominant sign of well-being. And socially, I think we've inherited again from ever since the 30s and 40s and 50s, the idea that our children must earn more income than us and that that's what means they'll have a better life. I don't see children marching in the streets today demanding higher incomes than their parents. I see children marching in the streets for a stable climate. They have switched metrics, and our politics and our politicians and our business needs to catch up.
Mm. So let's now talk about this decoupling that both of you have hinted at. Dietrich, on this show a couple of months ago, we had former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers on, Larry Summers on, and he basically said that anything, any bold plan in the United States that might put the reins on GDP growth would essentially render the U.S. economy comatose. And that's how allergic he was to the idea of putting the reins on growth here. But I'm looking at the title of your book. It's Why a Stagnant Economy is a Sign of Success. So should we not fear stagnation, and why?
We shouldn't. I mean, the short answer is no. I'm not proposing that we should target zero growth or slow growth, but I'm not really afraid of slow growth. I mean, I think that we have to conceive of from the economic side, the growth occurs fundamentally because we can either add more inputs into the economy, more labor, we could use more resources, we could build more capital, or we can get more productive at using those things. And productivity is the thing that has been driving the economy for decades and centuries. This is the fundamental source of all this growth. There's two ways to respond to that productivity. And one, the way we've been pursuing for a very long time, is to use the existing inputs, have higher productivity, and have higher growth, higher GDP. An equally valid response to higher productivity is to use fewer inputs, work fewer hours, use fewer resources, take a longer vacation. Those are all valid ways of taking advantage of productivity. So at risk of my own health, probably, in the economics community, perhaps, I will disagree with Larry Summers and say that, no, that's not something that is to be feared at all. And it's not the sense that the economy would become comatose. It's us taking advantage of productivity growth to do something different than we've done in the past. Productivity growth is the thing that we don't want to get rid of. because it allows us to make these choices where we reach the stage where we've decided to take the longer vacations, work less, use fewer resources, change our vision, as Kate was saying, kind of change our priorities.
So you're talking about us taking advantage of where we are as a nation. But your analysis also goes deeper, that the very structure of the economy has changed, right? That as we've moved away from a manufacturer or an economy driven by making stuff towards services, if I'm reading your argument right, that a service-based economy is going to have a naturally slower growth rate. Why is that?
Right. So this is an example of us already kind of making these choices, taking advantage of successes in the past, of productivity growth in the past, to choose to consume services and have smaller families and things like that that we didn't make choices in the past. And the slow growth that kind of comes out of shifting towards an economy focused more on services is there's a kind of a beautiful argument from an economist named William Baumol from back in the 60s about the difference between producing things and producing and services. And it really is the distinction between the use of time and labor. So if you buy a car, you don't even know how many people touched that car, worked on that car, or how long it took them to put it together. And so it's kind of if GM can figure out a way to make that car with less labor, great, it's cheaper for you and you don't really care. Services work differently in that the time and the attention you get from the people providing the service is really what you're buying, right? I can't get up in front of class and walk out after 20 minutes and say, yeah, I was really efficient today. So, my students would like it, but I can't really get away with that. My service is my time. And so it makes it very hard to actually increase productivity very fast. So as we've chosen to consume more of these services, there's a natural tendency for growth, economic growth, to slow down because we're choosing to buy things in which productivity growth has tended to slow down.
Okay, so a natural ceiling then. But in the long run, is that a problem?
No. I don't see that it's a problem at all, right? This is us making a choice in response to the prosperity we have enjoyed to consume in a different way and take advantage of some different opportunities. So there's nothing inherent about buying an extra refrigerator, say, a good, that makes the economy better than buying, say, an extra lecture at college or an extra trip or an extra vacation, all services, those kinds of things. There's nothing wrong with choosing one over the other. So we've made new choices.
I mean, you're saying that our sort of 2-ish% growth rate is almost entirely explained by this shift to a service economy.
The demographic shift and the services, for sure, right? The combo of the two explains basically the whole growth slowdown for the U.S.
Yeah. So a natural part of where a successful Western economy might be at this point in time. I mean, Kate Raworth, what do you think about that?
Well, I want to shift away from thinking about this growth going up or stagnant or down because I think it's last century's number, and we need to be looking at something different. So let's look at the dynamics of what our economies are producing. And I think Western high-income economies, like yours, like mine, are degenerative. We are running down the living planet in the way we produce things. We take resources, use them for a while, maybe just once, and then throw them away. So we are literally drawing on Earth's sources and spewing our waste into her sinks and pushing ourselves over planetary boundaries, causing climate breakdown, an ecological crisis. So these are the dramas of the times that we should create metrics for. We also have deeply divisive economies. America's just actually had a fantastic decade in terms of GDP. And yet 2 in 5 Americans say they'd struggle to come up with $400 in emergency. 1 in 3 households are classified as financially fragile. What is going on? With a 1% running away into the stratosphere. So we need to turn degenerative economies that run down the planet into regenerative ones that work with and within the cycles of the living world, that are circular economies that actually restore planetary processes. And we need to turn divisive economies into distributive ones so that the median wage rises, so that ordinary people doing precarious jobs actually find they're earning more and they feel more secure. So to me, these are the dynamics. I want to see more regenerative economies, far more distributive economies. And Then whether GDP goes up or down in that process, to me, it's a sort of knock-on effect. And that's why we have to take GDP off the pedestal and say GDP needs to respond so that we become more regenerative and more distributive. If in that process GDP rises, that's fine. If in that process GDP wavers around a fairly level rate, that has to be fine too, because getting bigger is not matter. You know, if my daughter is like 17-year-old daughter off to college and I say she's thriving, you're not going to say to me, yeah, but is she getting taller? That's not the point. The point is her life going well? So let's move away from a metric we know is not what we want. But what does matter, though, is that, as I was saying, we're financially, structurally dependent upon it. So pensions are invested in on the presumption of growth. Debt is taken out on the presumption of growth. So there are deep implications of accepting that growth is slowing, or it may come even to flatten out. Then we need to redesign our financial architecture to make sense of this new reality.
Well, it seems as if actually the analysis that Dietrich and you are both providing work in concert with each other, right?
Like, yes.
Dietrich is sort of telling us here's sort of how we have arrived at, in the United States, this GDP at 2% growth rate, and how and why. And Kate, you're talking about sort of the implications of the social, political, environmental implications of saying, okay, here's where we are. How do we need to rethink what the meaning and impact of these economies are? I see them as working together. And we want to explore that more in just a second. But Kate, you used the word specifically decoupling earlier. I just want you to explain to us clearly, what do you mean? What is being decoupled right now?
So when things are coupled, it means an increase in GDP leads to an increase in jobs. In fact, there was something in the 1960s, there's a US economist called Arthur Okun, and he noticed that in the 60s, when GDP increased by 2%, unemployment fell by 1%. And it was called Okun's Law. And this is why presidents pursued it, because this is how we get down unemployment. Just keep the economy growing. So there was a very tight relationship. If this one goes up, this one gets better. This one goes up, this gets better. They're like, it's as if they're strapped together and they're traveling together. And that's when things are deeply coupled or highly correlated, as a statistician would say. What we're seeing is that relationship is not a law. Okun's law was not a law. It comes apart. So one graph that was really big on social media a couple of years ago was US GDP up, 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 up. What's happening to the median wage? Until around the 70s, 80s, it was rising. It was coupled. It was going together with GDP. And then it flatlines. And the median wage has hardly changed while GDP's gone up, 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 waving goodbye. Sorry, you know, I'm not taking you with me. That's decoupling. And when these trends come apart, we have to deeply rethink the very deep presumptions that are held in economic classrooms, in politicians' speeches, that rising GDP is good for us all, because the data show it's not. They've come apart.
Dietrich, what do you think about the evidence about this decoupling, which I guarantee you many listeners hearing this right now are saying, yes, they have experienced this in their very lives.
Right. I think Kate's right on that we have kind of this built-in, I don't know what you call it, inertia or history of thinking about GDP as representing a good catch-all number for a number of dimensions of measuring well-being. And in the past, I think it probably was a decent indicator in the same sense. And I like that metaphor a lot of the GDP as a step tracker. And in the past, we were kind of unhealthy, you know, relatively poor. Then it is a good measure. The more you're stepping, oh, you must be getting healthier. You're out more. You're going farther. Your heart's probably getting healthier. This is great. All those things are coupled. Now, once you kind of reach a healthy state, which would be similar to where we are now, you've reached this healthy state. Well, all of a sudden, maybe you start doing other activities. And there's other dimensions of your health that you might start worrying about, like precisely what's going in your diet. Well, now your pedometer isn't telling you anything about the quality of the food you eat or the nutritional value that it has. In the past, it may have been informative, but I think Kate's right on in the sense that GDP is decoupled as being a good indicator of many, many aspects of well-being.
You know, so I've been lumping together slow growth and no growth together. Mm. They're not, obviously they are not the same, because again, a tip of the hat to John Cassidy in his New Yorker piece, he points out that even if the United States sort of plods ahead with this 2% growth rate in GDP, that the U.S. economy will still have doubled in the next 35 years. In a century from now, John Cassidy says the U.S. economy would be almost eight times its current size. So slow still means growth. And Dietrich, I wonder, I mean, to a fundamental point that Kate's trying to make here, should we not really start thinking about the literal constraints put upon us by nature, by Mother Nature, by the fact that we cannot have a century of even 2% growth without facing, you know, the constraints put us by on us by nature, by physics, by the sheer existence of material of natural resources.
So here's a point that I'll disagree a little with Kate's analysis. I agree that there are limits. Natural limits to the amount of resources we have, but in the same way that GDP is decoupled from a number of measures of well-being, GDP is not a terribly good indicator of how many physical resources we use. It's as she said towards the beginning, right? It's a measure of the value of the goods and services we produce in a given year in an economy, and that value is measured relative to years in the past. It can grow without using any new resources. It's possible, you know, as we've shifted from goods towards services, as we shift towards other kinds of activities, those are low resource intense activities relative to the past. We've seen this across most major economies. They've flatlined in the terms of the amount of energy they use. The certain amount of resources and inputs have fallen as we get more efficient. So it's not the case that an economy that's eight times bigger uses eight times as many resources or oil or energy. We may just be growing the economy in areas, sectors, industries, activities that we didn't before.
Well, Kate, when we come back from a quick break, I'll let you respond to that. We are talking about a new way of thinking about the great God of economic growth and whether we should be aiming for a slow or no growth economy, what that would look like, and what impact it would have. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are exploring the idea of whether developed Western economies, in this case, ought to be looking for slow or zero growth in that GDP number. And I'm joined today by Dietrich Wohlrath. He's author of Why a Stagnant Economy is a Sign of Success. And Kate Raworth also joins us. She's author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. And Kate, as you heard Dietrich say before the break, that an economy that's eight times the size of what it might be today isn't necessarily going to be eight times as harmful to the environment. That internal to that larger economy, we might be growing different parts of it that don't bump up against our sort of natural resources constraints. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and this is where the debate gets really fun. This is absolutely true, because when an economy moves, as the US has done in large part, from intensive manufacturing to services Absolutely, it uses fewer resources to generate its national income. But we need to distinguish between how a nation's income is generated and how a nation spends its income. So the US may be producing fewer cars and heavy industries and selling more healthcare services, education, legal services, IT services, music and culture, and that uses less materials. But what are people spending those earnings on? Americans are still building homes, buying large cars, eating burgers, buying new clothes every week, every month, buying electronics, a TV. These are being imported. Now, when we take a nation's consumption impacts into account, not just the production, but when we look at what a nation consumes, the data show us that the richest countries in the world are only slightly, some of them are actually reducing their carbon footprint in the world, but the material use, the lithium that goes in our batteries, in our electronics, our clothing, the food and the water that goes in, the fertilizers, it is not falling, and it's not falling anything like fast enough that it needs to do to come back within planetary boundaries. So yes, GDP and resource use can be decoupled, but it ain't being decoupled on anything like the scale that's required if we start saying we want a stable climate, we want fertile soils, we want abundant biodiversity, we want a protective ozone layer overhead. We want to pass on to our children a beautiful, balanced, healthy planet like the one we inherited. The way we are producing and consuming is nothing like on track to get us there.
I have to say, it gives me no end of joy to have a fun economics debate on this show. So, Dietrich, you want to respond to that?
I think the response I would give is that we've seen these kinds of situations and had these kinds of arguments in the past, in fact, right? So just with different resources, we've gone through, oh my God, we're going to run out of copper. There was a, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, the rate at which we're putting up houses and wiring things, everyone's freaking out about the amount of copper we use and the amount of copper that's been being used in the world that flatlined and then in fact started to fall, and the prices has plummeted over the last several decades. So we have different resources now that we're wary of, as Kate says. We're like, we're gonna, if we keep going on the same trajectory, we'll bump into these planetary limits. That's true, except that every example we've seen in the past, what happens is once we see these things starting to become more scarce, the price goes up, and all of a sudden we say, hey, we got to figure out a way to do without this stuff. And we in the past have been able to kind of innovate our way away from using these various resources. That doesn't guarantee we can do it again in the future, for sure. But the history suggests that we usually arrest these curves before we actually bump into limits. You know, the famous case of peak. If you go look up peak oil, you know, we're going to run out of oil. This has been going on. The earliest one I think I saw was somewhere around 1910 or 1915. People were worried about using up all the oil we've got. We'd like to use less, and we're starting to kind of flatline on a global level in the terms of amount of oil that's being used, but we've rarely gotten to the point where we actually are going to bump up against limits because prices start to kick in and show give us enough information to say, hey, we've got to move away from this resource.
Okay, so, yeah. So can I just jump in here? Because I would love to hear Kate's response to that, because I was wondering something along similar lines to what Dietrich just said, that perhaps are there not already, just by virtue of how human societies work, Kate, internal regulatory mechanisms. I mean, Dietrich was talking about price signals. I mean, we also have recessions that happen. Not that the impact of that recession on people's lives is something to be celebrated. It is not. But we're talking about forever growth as if it's inevitable. And I guess the question is, could it possibly not be inevitable?
So I want to say that the stories of running out of stuff, the fears, which were very true, the fear, oh, no, we're going to run out of copper, we're going to run out of iron, we're going to run out of oil. I'd say that's a very different debate to the one we have now, because as Dietrich says, those all have price signals around them. They are commodities. And when they seem to be getting scarce, the price goes up and people start drilling deeper and substituting away and use, oh, let's not use copper, let's use something else. We substituted away. This is very different. We're not running out of stuff. We are destroying the living systems of the planet. Mm-hmm. We are destroying our stable climate. We are destroying the integrity of the biosphere. We are draining the soils of fertility, and there is no price signal on these. So markets are not going to kick in with a mechanism and save us here. We have to radically bring in these metrics to the center of governance. So say a country starts having to govern itself by cutting its carbon emissions because the market doesn't provide a signal. We need politicians to look at the land footprint of their production and consumption. I'm working with some fabulous cities around the world like Amsterdam. I'm working with Portland and Philadelphia, which are ambitious cities saying we know we need to cut our consumption impact in the world. How can we transform at the city scale to make that happen? And we need to see the leadership that, frankly, mayors around the world are showing. And that needs to be shown at the national level.
Well, let me go to our callers here because they have been very patiently waiting. Let's go to Karen, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I've literally been waiting decades for this conversation to hit sort of the more national conversation, so it's thrilling. As a human being and a citizen, I am all over it. I love barter. I once knitted a sweater for somebody who did need some graphic design. I mean, I get it. As a small business owner, I own a restaurant. What challenges me is that all of the costs keep going up that benefit sort of the corporate-driven economy. And I'll give you an example and a possible solution, and I'd love your take on it. So we, years ago, agreed that in many states that affordable housing was an important value. So we started structuring zoning and sort of landlord issues around having some of that available. The problem that small business owners have is that there is nothing similar to level the playing field for access to good Main Street space. So restaurant owners like myself, local bookstores, there's this false equivalency that says we should be able to compete against a bank or a real estate office for the same space. And my argument always is, but we provide more. So how do we inject into this conversation the ideas of what are the extraneous benefits of the variety of businesses that you can have in any given town center, Main Street space? Because if we are truly going to have vibrant communities, we need, you know, small business need access to those spaces in reality, not just in you know, lip service that says, oh, well, you can rent it, but the bank could be $100 a square foot and you can't, so too bad.
Yeah, I hear you, Karen, and thank you so much for that call. So Karen's story, her experience, gets us to something Kate was saying earlier about how profoundly the fingers of growth are embedded into everything about sort of how we do business and how we live. And Karen's, you know, Dietrich, let me turn this one to you. If we're going to start turning away from that or looking at a different way of measuring what the prosperity of a nation is, I mean, she's got a really simple example. Like, she has to grow in order to, as a small business, and just to, like, keep the roof over her business's head. So how do we change that?
Well, I think this gets back to a couple really good points that Kate made, which one is that it's not just that growth was seen as really relevant on its own in the past, but we've built a lot of structures on top of the assumption of growth, you know, financial growth, profits, that kind of thing. And that's getting precisely to this. Like, how does a small business owner like Karen compete on a growth basis with, you know, Applebee's or whoever is taking over the good restaurant space where, you know, in Newton? So that how do you translate from a world which is based on that growth to something that is maybe more accessible to small business owners? And that gets to another point that Kate made about the lack of kind of information or prices. It's that where is the signal that shows the value of the local restaurant over above and beyond kind of the profits it generates to that community? Relative to the chain restaurant.
Yeah.
So that could be things that take place, like you said. I think, you know, at the local level, I think there's more and more places taking that into account and wondering, do we want the large chain place in, or do we want to support the local businesses? And now maybe I think there's starting to become a more appreciation that we do want to support those, but that has a cost, but we're willing to pay it. And if we could make that more explicit somehow, that would, I think, in some sense be valuable because it would allow us to really see what those places were contributing to these communities.
Well, Kate, I'm going to come back to you in a second. But before I run out of time, let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. This is
really such an important topic, and I'm so glad we're having this conversation. So I'm a young beginning farmer on a diversified small farm in Wisconsin. We're in the middle of CAFO country. So like 20 years ago, the average herd size of dairy cows was tiny, you know, like 70 to 100 cows. Now it's increased to 200, 300, but there's more and more mega farms, 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 cows. And they're following the same unlimited growth pattern where even when milk prices are down and we're losing 700 farms a year, they're still putting on more cows. They're not feeling those economic impacts, not only the economic impacts, but also the environmental issues. We don't have enough soil to spread out all the waste product.
Yeah.
So what is happening is we're squeezing out the small farms that can diversify and really effectively get high quality, high nutritious food out there while managing those nutrients in a much more effective way.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for that call. So, Kate Raworth, we have just a couple of minutes left to go. And we're at the point of the conversation where we just need to face head on the fact that we can have these different economic frameworks to look at what growth, or actually, let me change the phrase, what true prosperity actually means. But that meets the political realities of, you know, making that as much part of our policy as growth is. Do you see that, even the beginnings of that being able to happen?
Yes, and I think those two callers were a fascinating example. We have a family-owned restaurant. We have a family-owned farm, both of them saying, I'm being squeezed out by the big chain, by the corporates. Family-owned businesses actually don't try to grow forever because families want time with their families. They grow until they're thriving, and then they generally say, you know what, we're big enough, this is great, and actually we care more than about the profit. We care about, as Andrew was saying, we care about the soil. We care about multiples of things. We care about the community around us. Corporate-owned companies are legally obliged, in many countries' law, to maximize returns to shareholders. And so they put on a very different head when they come to work in the morning, and they are driving returns for shareholders. And so we need the beginnings of a new model is beginning by redesigning the entities of business. Some states in the U.S. offer tax deductions for family-owned and employee-owned firms because they know they're sticky. They stick around. They're not going to up and leave when the wage rate drops in another state or in another country. And it's that kind of recognition of what I was talking about, distributive design, distributing the value in places where people make community, and it's an ecosystem of small enterprises. We need to redesign the corporate model so that it stops endlessly extracting capital, extracting. It's never enough. People who work in companies say, I sweated my butt. You know, I delivered great results and my manager said, well done, and another 5% next year. And there's never enough. We need to redesign that model to make it belong on planet Earth.
Right. So, Dietrich, I come back to what Robert Kennedy said in 1968, right? I just quoted him when he said that GDP measures everything except that which is worthwhile. And I've pulled up RFK's speech here, and I just want to read another little section of it. Because he said, the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It seems to me now, Dietrich, that we maybe optimistically actually are at a place, given the sort of structure, the changes in the structure of the economy that you've been talking about, that we should be able to use these as the signals of what prosperity is. Can we do that?
Yes. And I think one of the messages I came to me and that I tried to put in the book when I was writing it was that economic growth has been a great thing, and it's put us in this position to now have this the freedom to make these wider choices about what we want to focus on, to have the resources or the ability to produce that's available. We're like, so that it's become kind of inexcusable that people aren't able to find a place to live or to have enough to eat, or to be able to get insulin. we're at the stage. Growth has given us the capability to address these things, and I think we are. And the very optimistic look on this is that we are at a place where we can start rethinking what we would like to focus on. And in terms of, say, supporting, and I feel a lot of sympathy and a lot of connection with Andrew on this, having grown up on a dairy farm in central Wisconsin with a very small number of cows, that this is the kind of thing we can look at as saying our economy is big and it's gotten big enough to support lots of activities that maybe don't generate super high growth.
Well, maybe the word that we shouldn't be afraid, but we, you know, we talk about growth, we talk about stagnation, but maybe we should be thinking about this in terms of equilibrium. So that's the thought I'm going to leave us all with. Dietrich Wohlrath, chair of the economics department at the University of Houston and author of Why a Stagnant Economy is a Sign of Success. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great. Thank you very much.
And Kate Raworth, author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist and also an Ecological Economist at Oxford University. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you, Kate. Thank you.
Absolutely my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.